Great to have you with us along here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of wildlife. There's lots of spring migrating birds that have found their way back into the state already. We'll be talking about those birds, talk a lot more. We've got lots of topics that we can talk about. The roller coaster weather, breeding activity for birds, the turkey season, and a whole lot more. I hope you'll join in with your own observations of wildlife, your own questions or comments. Scott Craven, UW Emeritus Extension Wildlife Ecologist, and he comes by usually every other month, if I'm not mistaken, on the first Wednesday. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Scott, welcome back.
It's great to be here, Larry. It's always nice for me. It's just nice to be out of the hospital.
Why do you always go to the hospital, Scott?
Well, it's been a bit of a tough run in that regard, but I had no choice this last week when my gallbladder decided to give up the good fight, and
that was just last week. You were just
I got out of the hospital 4 days ago, but I feel. Getting rid of that gallbladder. You know, if you've got some spare time, I highly recommend you get rid of your gallbladder because it wasn't doing anything for me. And I, within 24 hours of the surgery, I felt as good as I've felt for years. So it was all good.
Well, it's kind of been a roller coaster ride for you health-wise and probably because of that gallbladder. It's been a kind of a roller coaster March weather too, February, March weather.
Yeah, I think people, including myself, tend to forget that it's probably like this every year.
Yeah,
I mean,
probably.
All of a sudden, there's a few nice days. Then all of a sudden, a storm sneaks in. And then there's a few more nice days. But overall, I think this weekend here around the Madison area, we finally hit 40 for the average daily high. So you know we're on the upswing. We go on daylight savings time this weekend, I believe, as
yes,
well.
Yes, we do.
So it's going to seem lighter. It will be lighter longer. The temperatures are increasing. The sun's high in the sky. So even though it's cold out today, the snow's melting on the roofs and roads and whatnot. So all things considered, the birds that made a modest tactical error in coming back before that snow will be just fine. And by the end of the month, I think spring will be in full swing.
Yeah. Well, over the weekend, I was out somewhere wandering in the marshes and heard some sandhill cranes at it a little bit.
Cranes are back. The red wings came back.
Robins.
Saw some swans on the way in this morning. There's geese all over the place.
I'm hearing cardinals.
Lots of geese around. The cardinals are singing. Things will start happening very quickly. So as hopefully some listeners will call in and have some. The red wings, the robins, and so forth are pretty standard stuff. But maybe somebody's seen something a little more exotic, and we'll see what it is.
And you know what? When that snow goes away, the wildlife damage that may have occurred under the snow becomes apparent and visible.
Well, this should not be a bad year for that, at least in the southern part of the state. Now,
yeah.
Up around our cabin in Price County, I was talking to a neighbor up there a couple days ago. He said the snow is still 2 feet deep and then some. So it's vastly different depending on where you are. But here in southern Wisconsin, we were running even after this most recent storm, a good 10 inches low in terms of snow depth or accumulated snow over the course of the winter. So there were quite a few bare ground periods. So the kinds of things that people generally don't notice until March when the persistent snow cover finally leaves, like all the vole tunnels around the grass and gnawing damage to landscape plants or fruit trees or those kinds of things. They haven't happened to the extent that they normally do, and B, that kind of thing's been more visible all winter. So the shock value of some of these things for most people shouldn't be nearly as great as it is in some years.
At least in southern Wisconsin.
Right. And in many cases, these things are cosmetic issues anyway, that once things green up, they'll take care of themselves.
Well, Tom in Eau Claire has something for you, Scott, so let's go there. Tom, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, great program so far. Last week when you had the expert on chronic wasting disease on, I wasn't able to call in and pose this question, but with regards to recreational baiting for enjoying the deer in my yard in a rural setting. If chronic wasting disease is spread through saliva, which I don't know if that's still the current hypothesis or if it's because they're congregated, if that would be in fact the case, wouldn't all of the urban deer within our cities be decimated if it was transmitted that fashion? I'm certainly no biologic expert, but that's what my common sense hunch tells me. I was wondering if you might have an opinion on that, Scott.
Yeah. Well, I do, and I this is in reference to Mike Foy being on, talking
yes,
about his
Foy.
Plan. Okay. Well, you're right that one of the prime incentives for trying to, you know, finally get feeding and baiting under control or banned entirely in the state is because of disease transmission. And you were right on both counts that close contact of deer, which tends to happen around piles of corn and things like that, plus then the facilitated transfer of bodily fluids, be it saliva or anything else, both facilitate the perpetuation or infection with chronic wasting disease. So you're right on all those counts.
I'm not sure why
you feel this would be made that much worse in an urban area. Are you still on?
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
What
point is, I don't think we know enough about it, and saliva is not the common method of transmission, because then you'd see all these urban deer tipping over and dying in our backyards.
Why would it be any worse in the urban environment?
Because they're so tightly congregated and they eat out of tiny bird feeders and small little piles of corn.
Well, I guess the only thing I can say about that is maybe, but I think you're right that we don't know very much about that. And the level of concern for deer in the urban environment, where in most cases we'd like to see a lot less of them, if any at all, there's just not a great deal of attention paid to them. And in places like the Arboretum and other places where there's an active program to try and thin them out, then, you know, that may mitigate the problem. But I don't think we have any particular evidence that because deer are scooting around our city parks and greenways and whatnot, that they're any more susceptible than deer in the rural environment. And because they are in an area where there's a heavy human footprint, if they were sick and displaying signs of advanced chronic wasting disease or dying in somebody's backyard, we'd hear about it,
and
we don't. Yeah. So I don't know what more to say about it than that.
Yeah, interesting, Tom. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take another call. Let's go to Reese in Door County. Reese, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I had a question about grout.
Okay.
I'm a delivery driver of propane, and a couple of times on different properties, I think I've had the same grout. He's not afraid of the truck. He'll follow me back to the truck. Last time he hopped up on the delivery hose a few feet from me, and he was just talking and talking. And...
This is not an uncommon story, actually.
This is not an uncommon story, and it's widely known in the circles of people who work with or appreciate rough grouse that or live amongst them, that for whatever reason, and it's not fully understood, individual birds will exhibit extreme tameness and apparent curiosity. And I would say over the years on both the radio program and as I was an active extension specialist and people were sending me pictures or calling or whatever, I mean, God, I'll bet if my memory was better, we could probably come up with several dozen instances where people had a grouse around their yard that as soon as they came out on the lawn tractor, the grouse would run out and fly up on their shoulder.
I remember that story.
Or up on the tractor and ride all around the yard with them and then eventually hop off and go about its business. Or they'd come up while people were having a cocktail on the patio and see what was going on. So that extreme tameness is both documented by, you know, people passing it along as kind of a verbal verbal history, but it's also mentioned in some of the books about rough grouse and their biology. But again, it's poorly understood. If you happen to be on the recipient end of it, it's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah.
But that tameness does not serve the grouse well in the long run, and it may ultimately lead to their demise. But it does happen, and we'll add you to the list of of beneficiaries of that strange behavior.
Very cool, Reese. Thanks a lot for calling. Let's go to Mary in Oshkosh next. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Larry, and hi, Scott. Boy, I wish this were as exciting as grouse following me around, but what I've got are mice in my house.
They're following you around.
I've got them in my attic. I hear them scritching in the wall and in the ceiling. And what I think they've gotten worse over the 15 years that I've been living in the house. But what I really want to know from you, Scott, is what are the habits of mice in terms of where do they spend their time? Is this something that I should be expecting in the winter, colder months only? Do they leave my attic in the summer? What are the habits that they have? And if you have any advice for getting rid of them, other than cats, which are not doing their job.
Well, settle in, Larry. This is going to take a few minutes. Well, first of all, Mary, all mice are not created equal. So my first question for you is, are you sure you're dealing with mice and all mice? Have you caught some of them, seen them, or is it just the scritching in the walls that seems to suggest that they're in there? And the reason I ask is that there are certainly other animals that could be present that would, especially in the attic.
Yeah.
High up in the house is less likely to be mice, actually, than down in the lower walls or in the floorboards or whatever. Certainly could still be mice. White-footed or deer mice are excellent climbers, and they could find their way up into the attic. But again, they're far more likely to be in the basement or the lower walls or the garage or outbuildings or that kind of thing. So, we'll come back to that question. Let's assume that we're dealing with mice, and there are a lot of different species of mice in Wisconsin, but the two that most homeowners are concerned about are either house mice, standard invasive species, beady little eyes, big ear. Everybody understands house mice. They're uniformly colored around the mouse, so their belly's gray, their back's gray, and so forth, whereas most of our native field mice, and there are three species in the same genus, Paramyscus, and collectively, they're usually called field mice, white-footed mice, deer mice, all essentially the same animal as far as most people are concerned. These are the ones that are very common outside, around everybody's yard, in the wood pile, in the landscaping, and so forth, and they tend to come in to the buildings in the fall when it starts to get cold. And that's when they're inside, over winter. As things are warming up now, I would expect them to head back out. In my own case, the major source of frustration for the other half of the family, that, hey, you're a wildlife specialist, for crying out loud, get rid of these mice. Well, easier said than done. They can find their way in through a very tiny hole, and once they're in, they move freely throughout the house. Oh, I'm not even going to tell the story. We had our ductwork cleaned a few weeks ago, Larry, which is something most people put off for years.
Years, yeah.
Well, all I can say is that when the ducts were all opened up, there were mice involved. And we're not talking just a couple of mice. This was quite a convention. But anyway, in all probability, over winter, you're dealing with the white-footed mice or field mice. If it's around the clock, essentially, throughout the year, and there's mice in the kitchen, mice in the pantry, mice in the closet, those are more likely to be house mice. Either way, and there are certainly others. The common designation field mouse is also applied to the voles, the short-tailed, stubby little guys, which are not mice at all, but voles, but they rarely, if ever, come into a building.
Right.
So there are a few other animals that might come in, but those are the two basic groups of mice. Whichever one it is, they're generally treated the same way by trapping, toxicants, mouse proofing, and perhaps a few other basic tactics. But in terms of them being in there, I think that kind of covers it. Where would you like to go from here? Would you
Are they in the? If the, what else could be in the attic? The squirrels,
bats? Flying squirrels, bats, even something bigger. Even starlings coming in through the soffit or something. There are a lot of possibilities. But
I did get a pest guy in here, and he said it was mice.
Okay, well, and did the pest guy offer up a control program, or are they working on a
Yeah, quite expensive, pretty much recladding the house.
Doing what to the house? Residing it?
Yeah, he pointed out holes all over the house and window wells, behind the brick, fascia, and other areas that were entry points.
Well,
so
that...
He was not very optimistic of being able to solve the problem.
So this is an older building, an older home?
1985, no. Not that old. Mm-mm.
Well... First thing, and I think this holds true of any type of home repair or home activity, get a couple different people in to give you an estimate and an assessment and see where they agree and where they disagree. Certainly, there are many access points for these mice, and the sad thing is the mice are capable of making their own access point. They find a corner or a little bit of loose insulation that's in their way, they're going to go right through it. Because their teeth are very powerful. But that doesn't mean there aren't materials they can't or won't go through that either you or a family member or whatever can install, be it steel wool or other things like that, and eliminate a lot of that access right off the bat. So I would get a couple more people to come through and give you some assessment. But in the meantime, you could certainly be putting out mouse traps and you get pretty good with them and learn how to use them, and you can thin those mice out in a hurry.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, Mary. Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Scott Craven, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in as we talk the world of wildlife with you. There's one open line at 800-642-1234. And you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's see. We've got Norman in Wausau has been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Norman, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. Say, I have a very quick solution for people who have done everything to keep mice out of their house and they still have them up in their attic. And that is that ridge vent that they put on the top of the house is usually made out of plastic, and those dang mice get up on top of that roof either by dropping off of limbs from nearby trees or somehow crawling up there. They chew a hole through the edge underneath the shingles where that ridge vent is and drop down into your attic. And I found that out because I had to go up there for something, and I found a long trail of maple seed, the whirly part of it, not the seed. The seeds were gone, just in a line all the way along the ridge vent. And for the first time, I found out why I always had mice up in the attic. And I closed that up by putting metal flashing, perforated flashing, and then putting the plastic venting, and then the shingles on top of that. And that's been the end of my mouse problem up in the attic ever since.
Oh. Well, good job, and keep up the good work. But ridge vent, soffit vents, utility cable entrance holes, a broken... There are
so many.
Mice are very resourceful, and if you're lucky enough to find a kind of a major entry point and you can eliminate it, good luck to you.
Good job, Norman. Thank you for calling. Well, Dennis in Clintonville is online, too, with a question. Let's go there. Hi, Dennis. Dennis, we can't hear you. I guess we can't hear him. We lost Dennis, so he had a question about the
Winter Severity Index?
Yeah, for the northern deer herd.
Yeah, I haven't, you know, we were going along pretty well on that. There had been some cold. That spell around Christmas was brutal. But beyond that, there haven't been any prolonged cold spells. And the deep snow is a relatively recent phenomenon. So I would suspect it may end up in the moderate range, but I haven't seen anything released on that yet. Usually as the snow starts to disappear in the north, the DNR will get out some press releases on that.
I remember you telling me, or maybe it was somebody from the DNR, that sometimes these late-season snowstorms, if they're prolonged, can have a worse impact than the early ones because the herd may be, you know, it may have used up a lot of its food supplies.
Right. You know, at this point, it's the end of winter. The deer and a lot of other wildlife species need winter to be over. And if we get hammered late, that can be more problematic.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Jolie in Vilas County then. Jolie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, and I want to get ready for this, be prepared for it. Last summer, we had many, many snakes on our shoreline, and they were the northern water snakes, and they're maybe 3-4 feet long, pretty thick, and they would go on the dock, sun themselves on the dock, sun themselves on the edge, and they would even sneak into my boat and get on the flooring and sneak down underneath there, and I didn't. What can I do to chase them across, back over, across the other way? Is there
you
any
mean back
way?
back over to your neighbor's front edge?
Yes, let them kick
well,
you.
Well, is there anything about your front edge that would seem to you to be? I mean, think like a snake here for a moment. Do you have a lot of rock riprap? Do you have a lot of shoreline brush? Is there anything that, as you look at your shoreline, seems to be potentially attractive to the snakes?
Well, they trimmed it. We trimmed it this time, you know, cutting it way down. And this year was the first year where water was up higher than it had normally been. So I don't know if the trim, if
well,
we couldn't have cut the grasses.
I don't know that that would have made any difference. The water level change could have. I have a few water snakes around our lakefront property in Price County, and you know the kids kind of think they're sort of cool. So I'm not overly troubled by that. I mean, water snakes in general are considered harmless, except for the fact that they have a notoriously nasty disposition. So unlike garter snakes, for example, that you could easily put on a glove and pick them up and you know move them.
Yeah.
A few hundred yards down the shoreline, water snakes take a dim view of that, and they'll at least act as aggressive as they can, although they can't do very much. I mean, how many snakes are we talking here? You see three or four at a time, or dozens? Or
well, I know in our boat that one time, we wanted to go for a boat ride, and my husband said, the heck with this, we're going to go with those snakes in it or not. And we had six snakes, and he would grab them and throw them out into the lake. I wish I would have gotten a video on that because I would have never done that.
I would have liked to have seen that myself.
Me too.
Well, and the muskies probably got them at that point, but
well, I hope, or the eagles. I don't know why the eagles don't swoop down and take them off of the dock.
Boy,
I have no idea.
I don't know what to tell you here. If there was something obvious, like they were denning up or spending the winter in a big rock pile on the shoreline or something else that would be attractive to them, then you might be able to modify that habitat a bit. The only other thing I can suggest, and you'd have to look at the product and read the label to see if the genus name for northern banded water snake, Nerodia, is on there, is a commercial product called Dr. T's Snake Away.
Hmm.
It's made of, it's a granular product, comes in a canister, 4 or 5 pound canister. It's a mix of ground sulfur and ground naphthalene, and it's used as a perimeter treatment around house foundations or some such thing, and apparently again, it's said to work on some snake species, not on others. So you could look into that or something comparable, and then this stuff would just be sprinkled as if you were salting an ear of corn along the shoreline, and that might discourage them a bit to move off to the side or move to someone else's property. Beyond that, since your husband seems to be adept at grabbing them, get yourself an old pillowcase to put them in, and as the opportunity presents itself to get a hold of them, put them in a pillowcase and, you know, relocate them, put them in the boat, relocate them to an undeveloped area along the lakeshore. Don't kill them. There's no need to do that. But relocate them somewhere else on the lake or down the road a mile or so, and eventually you'll get ahead of it, because they're not generally prone to really dense populations.
There you go.
And the water level may have had something to do with it. If the water's down this year or up even higher, you may not see them. So
yeah, there you go.
Good luck.
Yeah, you adjusting. You need to be. You need to always be thinking. I was pondering my own situation with the. With the dock where the mallards would jump up on my dock and would poop all over the dock all the time, and they never were on the neighbor's dock. And I noticed that the neighbor's dock was about 6 inches lower, or 6 inches higher than mine. So the next year, I raised the legs on the dock and made them higher than the neighbor's. And then they went over to the neighbors. I never told the neighbor that. Oh, boy.
Good work, Larry. Yeah, good work.
Always thinking, always thinking. Sally and Eau Claire, what's on your mind?
Well, good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
I have kind of a fun question, I guess.
Okay.
We all look forward to seeing the first robin, and I've lived in different parts of Wisconsin, but everywhere we've lived, we've heard, oh, we saw the first robin. That means only three more snowfalls until it's spring, or spring, maybe spring is here for good. I just was wondering, where did that saying originate? Is that like a farmer's almanac, or...
Well, you know, there's some old world basis to Groundhog Day, for example, on six more weeks of winter. But frankly, I've never heard the robins are back, so it's going to snow three more times.
I heard that one. I have heard that one.
Larry's heard of this, so he's going to describe the origin of that statement in folklore for us, because I haven't a clue.
Yeah, I know I've heard it. Well, I haven't heard it in a long time, but I remember hearing it as a young guy.
There are so many things like that going along between Groundhog Day and this one about this, and gee, the first snow in April is the onion snow because people have planted their onions and that'll help them grow or something. There's almost no end to these things, but I can someone may have coined that phrase for who knows what reason, but I can think of no meteorological background to it at all.
There's no meteorological basis for it, Sally. But you know what? Stay listening, because somebody else may have in mind the kind of the history of that saying, and we'll have them call in.
We'll turn to the audience.
Once in a while. Or Jill, do you know? Jill Nano, my producer, she does not know. So if she doesn't know, then it's probably not very well known. But someone may know.
Someone will know.
Somebody's going to know. So stay listening, Sally.
I will.
All right, thanks. Arlen in Juliet, or is it Gillett?
Yes, that's Gillett.
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call. Thank you for this show. I always look forward to listening to Scott.
All right, thank you.
Anyway, I'm looking at a field guide for mammals in Wisconsin. I won't mention the name of the publication or the author. You probably know who it is, but anyway. It lists some of the rare species. It'll list, for example, when it's under moose, it'll say rare.
You know what, Arlen, we're not hearing you well. Did you get away from the mouth of your phone?
Is that better now?
Yes.
Much better.
Okay, let's go with this. This is a field guide for mammals in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And it lists some of the rare species. When it lists moose, for example, it'll say rare, or cougar, or lynx, it'll say rare, like that. But there's one listing in there that just blows my mind, and that is for caribou.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a statement that in the last century, only rare sightings of caribou have been made in Wisconsin. And I've learned to never say never, but this sounds like a stretch to me.
Caribou, although once present in the northern tier of counties, it's my impression they were extirpated or eliminated back in the, I'm going to say the late 1800s.
Yeah, I was going to say 1890s.
I'm not aware of any valid records in, certainly in the 50 years that I've been in Wisconsin, but probably for 50 or more before that as well. So, I mean, that's one of those things like wolverines that, they were here, but they're not close anymore. And if something is seen, like a wolverine or a few other species, when you dig into it deeply enough, you usually figure out eventually that it was an escape from someone's captive animal exhibit or something else. But I've not heard anything like that with regard to caribou. And there's none close enough to us that a wandering animal, like all these cougars that have finally been documented thanks to trail cameras, coming to us from the Dakotas and points west and wandering through, those animals cover a lot of ground. That would not be the case with caribou.
No.
I'm thinking even extreme northern Minnesota, it would be awfully rare, probably.
Yes.
Yeah, very, very rare. Or maybe somebody saw an elk and thought it was a caribou.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, too. Well, I just wanted your input on that. It correlates with what my research has come up with, too. So.
All right.
Excellent.
Good.
Thank you for calling.
Appreciate the call. On to Kathy in Hartford. Kathy, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to ask again about mice, and I heard you talking earlier about how much the field mice love to come in and fall. And I was wondering, do you need to be concerned that they could be bringing deer ticks into your house?
Do deer ticks attach themselves to field mice?
Deer and white-footed mice are involved in the transmission of Lyme's disease, and the ticks there are an issue, but deer ticks. Usually it's gotten pretty cold before they start to move inside. They wait until the last minute. I think they'd prefer to be outside if they could be. And by that point, the tick populations are starting to drop off. I guess it's possible, but I've not heard of that being a problem.
Ooh. Great.
All right.
At least amongst the many deer mice frequenting my home, that's not something, and I hope my wife's not listening to the program now. But in any event, I don't believe that's a big problem.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, boy. Rusty in Stevens Point. Hello to you.
Hey, thanks, guys. A little bit of history. Almost 20 years ago, a fellow I know was raising what they're called. They were just a breed of white deer, pure white, but not albino. They did not have the pink nose or pink features on them. Unfortunately, some of these deer were chased out of a pen. And although it was neat at the time, we had some of them. I live in central Wisconsin, west of Stevens Point, north of Wisconsin Rapids. And at the time, one of those white does, settled into our 40 acres of ours. And over the years, now these deer are able to breed with white tails. And at the time, we looked it up and checked it out, and we were told that the white tail could breed with these white deer, and at least one out of every seven fawns could be white. Well, as it turns out, over the years, we've seen as many as two fawns, white fawns per doe, one white fawn, one brown fawn. The thing of it is, you can't shoot these white deer, and now 20 years later, there is an unbelievable proliferation of these white deer, and a lot of the locals are wondering what's going on. They're on the west side of the Wisconsin River, west side of Stevens Point, all the way. There's some now in Wisconsin Rapids. I saw some not too long ago. They're Junction City area. These deer are spreading all over, and people are concerned that, geez, you know, what's going to happen down the road? And I've called in on this before to a different show, and I was told that this wasn't happening, that these were albino, but I know for a fact these are not albino deer. Mm.
Well, whether they're albino or leucistic or what, piebald or what have you, given their proliferation and breeding freely with normal coloration whitetails, this must have started with a whitetail population. I mean, I don't think we're talking about fallow deer or any exotic species here. I'm kind of surprised about this. Well, I'm not kind of surprised. I am surprised because first I have ever heard of it. And given all the attention that the relatively small population of albinos gets up around Boulder Junction, for example, with the books written on them and photographs and art and assorted other things, I'm kind of surprised there hasn't been some attention focused on this area. So,
what about shooting them? Is it illegal to shoot?
I get this mixed up with a variety of different states, but I think you are not supposed to shoot a white deer in Wisconsin. And the reality is that biologically there's no particular reason for that other than that people are fascinated by an anomaly or a curiosity, and that probably led to the original protection. However, if they're proliferating at this rate and people are concerned about it locally, the way things seem to get done now, I think my advice to Rusty or the group of people who are group of neighbors get together and approach their local legislator after meeting with the DNR wildlife manager for the area, see where that leads them after they meet with the DNR, and then if there's concern that, hey, this is, you know, it's time to get these laws changed. And I guess I would have, from Rusty's perspective or the other people who are concerned, you know, what is the concern? Is the concern that they're going to be overrun with white deer that are going to cause crop damage and they can't do anything about it because they're white? Or are they being hit at a dangerous level by motor vehicle traffic? Or is there something else going on? So armed with a few facts and some valid concerns, then I think the first step is to approach the DNR, and the second step, either perhaps in conjunction with the DNR, is to approach a local legislator and see whether they can get some relief or if it's even needed.
Yeah, makes sense to me.
And that's about all I can say about it. Yeah. But I'm surprised that this hasn't attained some publicity.
First I've heard. Rusty, thank you for calling. Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You are listening to the wonderful World of Wisconsin Wildlife program here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Scott Craven. Great to have you listening in. Well, the lines are all filled. We're getting some emails and some photos, and we'll get to those. But I know there are a couple of events, Scott, that you wanted to mention, and let's do that before we forget.
There are a couple of things. In particular, some opportunities for public engagement in the natural resources management process. And these are coming up beginning next week around the state. The County Deer Advisory Committees, or CDACs as they're called, for every county will be holding their spring meeting where they discuss preliminary recommendations for next fall's deer quotas, antlerless harvest quotas, and other issues relating to deer management in the given counties. And I have here the list by county, which was in the last issue of Outdoor News, but it's also available on the DNR website if you search under CDACs, and you can learn a little bit about those committees. And in particular, you can actually get on the committees if there are openings. There are, I don't know, six or seven, eight members on each one representing forestry interests, transportation interests, a hunting community, the Conservation Congress, the DNR, and so forth. And it's an opportunity to have a voice in your local county. However, they're also open to the public, so whether you're a committee member or not, welcome to attend these meetings and voice your opinion. Too many deer, not enough deer, we need bigger deer, whatever. So this is your chance, and those are coming up in Dane County here, for example. I'm on the CDAC, and we meet next Wednesday night, so a week from tonight. Then a couple weeks further along, the first Monday of April, historically is the night that the Conservation Congress spring hearings are held, again, throughout the state. So there'll be a meeting in a public facility, usually a high school gym or a town hall or something, in every county in the state. And again, everybody, you don't have to be a hunter, fisher, trapper, or whatever. Anybody can go and provide input on the many questions that are put forth for potentially reaching the regulations phase down the road. So there will be questions about fishing, hunting, and assorted other things. I've got some. The list of questions, the actual questionnaire is available. It's usually long. It's on the DNR website, but they'll be proposing that another color be added to blaze and pink, blaze orange and pink, that being the fluorescent yellow that's used by highway workers and so forth to make that legal as a safety color for hunting. And there's questions about all sorts of fishing issues in terms of the early trout season and bass regulations. If you're interested in that kind of thing, hey, it's an evening out. It's an evening out with like-minded people. Make your input be heard. The weekend after that, on April 14th, will be the induction ceremony for the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame up in Stevens Point, and three pretty well-known people being inducted this time around. A.W. Schorger from the university here will be inducted. George Meyer is well known for his, he was DNR secretary, but he's been very active for many years now, heading up the Wildlife Federation and so forth. So George and A.W. and also Roy and Charlotte Lukes from Door County. Roy, in particular, very well known naturalist and worked at the Ridges Sanctuary there at Bailey's Harbor for many years. So it's a really good group of inductees, and that, too, is open to the public. And then lastly, what was lastly? Larry, what was lastly here? Two other plugs. One is, hey, unfortunately, tax time is coming up. Again, as always, consider a donation to the Endangered Resources Tax Checkoff on the state form. You'll have a chance to help about 400 wildlife species and 300 plants that are either threatened, endangered, or declining. And then finally, for folks who are interested in urban wildlife or wildlife around the home, on the same day as you're going to have to make a choice, folks. Mm-hmm. You can't go to the induction for the Hall of Fame and the Urban Wildlife Workshop. But on Saturday the 14th from 12 noon to 4 p.m. at the University Arboretum here in Madison, there'll be essentially a workshop on urban wildlife. There is a registration fee, but that includes 4 hours of in-class training, resource materials, and refreshments. You do need to register in advance, sponsored by Dane County Extension and my department here on campus. And if you want more information, go to the Dane County UW Extension website and you can sign up. And you're going to learn about wildlife trends, land use issues, practices to create habitat around your yard. Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, sounds pretty good to me as well.
That's all I got, Larry. All I've got.
No, that's a lot. Steve in Sun Prairie has a lot, too, I bet. Let's go there. He's been waiting a bit. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Scott, Larry, thank you very much for taking my call. It's a great show, as always. I was looking out the window about 3-4 weeks ago, and there were a couple of gray squirrels chasing each other around the yard, up and down trees. Just looked like they were either fighting or having quite a good time. And then I kind of thought, well, I wonder if this is some sort of a mating ritual. And one of the squirrels, they got up in a tree, and one of the squirrels did something I've never seen before. He was hanging on a branch. I say he, I don't know, was a he for sure, but
it was
hanging on a branch. And his tail started to go around like a propeller. And he did that for a couple of minutes. And then he stopped and flicked his tail up and down and up and down like squirrels do. And then he started that propeller rotation again. And I wondered, is that some sort of a meeting? Come on. Do you have any idea?
Well, that one I haven't heard before.
Well, yeah, I agree with Larry. When squirrels use their tail for a lot of things, that's a very important appendage for a squirrel. It's a balance beam. It's a blanket. It's a signal tool. They use it for a lot of stuff, and especially when they're agitated or very active, whether it's breeding activity or aggressive activity, that tail, the flicking you described, and maybe the rotational issue for that particular squirrel was an important aggressive posture that, hey, there's another squirrel around, stay the heck away from me, this is not a good time, or whatever. When you see them for the last month or so chasing each other around, up and down the trees, over and about, it's either a male and a female as a prelude to breeding, or it's two males that have decided, hey, there's not room for both of us in this backyard. But breeding activity has been going on for a while. Typically, their first litters are born in March, and then they'll have another litter midsummer. So there are probably den trees now with baby squirrels in them already. And if they're not, there will be soon. So I have no doubt that what you were seeing was related to the breeding season, but whether it was aggression between a couple squirrels of the same sex or two squirrels of the opposite sex attempting to complete the breeding, we'll never know.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. That was an interesting story. I've never seen a squirrel with that behavior. Sound pretty cool. Rod in Weyerhaeuser, your turn. Hi, Rod.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, you were talking about snakes earlier. I metal scrap, and I got a lot of scrap around and the place here. And anyhow, the rats showed up. And I went last fall. I got an old 90 pickup. I wanted to get that thing going, which I did. But anyhow, when I went there, I opened up the door, it kind of startled me. And here, they were, I don't know, it must have been a whole nest of them, pine snakes, And, like I say, it kind of startled me. You don't expect that. But anyhow, I shut the door and I said, well, that's awesome, I said, when it starts getting colder, because I got the truck going in my old plow truck. And I said, well, we didn't have snow yet. But anyhow, so I left the truck in. I said, that's awesome. I said, I'll just leave them things go. Well, about 2 weeks after that, I was moving some stuff and loading some stuff, and I moved some stuff, and here goes this pine snake. It was probably about 5 foot, I would guess. 5 foot, it was, the sucker had a bulge in it, and I'm thinking, after that, I didn't really see that many rats. So I don't know. Pine snakes, I'm assuming, will take rats because they always said that, snakes are good for taking rodents and undesirable critters like that, and the way their jaws work and stuff, how they can eat something bigger, I've seen that on Wisconsin Public TV, so I just want to say, if somebody's got pine snakes around, if they don't want critters around, don't kill them pine snakes.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Well, that's good, solid advice. Pine snakes, or some people know them as fox snakes, or northern fox snakes is the formal term, but around Wisconsin, most people call them pine snakes. They're one of our larger snakes. Series of blotches on the snake, but what really makes them easy to identify is the head color is copper-colored, like a penny, and no markings, just a nice uniform copper-colored head. And they do get up to, as he said, 5 feet, maybe 5.5 feet, and they can be pretty chunky. And they certainly will eat rodents. So rodent eating aside, there's no reason when you happen to, if you're lucky enough to come across a hibernaculum that has a lot of them in it, or you find them while you're cleaning up or whatever, as he was doing, leave them alone.
Yeah,
there's no reason to panic and say, oh my gosh, we got to get rid of these snakes. They'll clear out on their own for the warm season and disperse around the countryside. But
there you go. Thanks,
no problem.
A lot. That was a great story, Rod. Thank you for calling. And something relating to this whole issue comes from Terry in Mass City. Hi, Terry.
Hey, Larry. Yeah, I heard you guys talk about mice control. And I haven't had a mouse. I usually have lots of mice up here in this old house. Set out my traps and run my trap line every morning, But I haven't had a single mouse since last October. And the reason is I have an ermine that moved in with me.
Hmm.
I'm telling you, man, they're better than a cat. They can go anywhere their mouth goes, and I haven't had a single one here. So,
well, you're lucky. And first of all, an ermine or short-tailed weasel is same animal. Kind of neat to see. Most people don't get a chance to see them very often. They're not very big. They're very fast, and they're reasonably shy. But they're great mousers, and if you can peacefully cohabitate with a short-tailed weasel in the walls or wherever it's living, and it's taking care of your mice,
more power to you.
Yeah, and they're not dirty. They're not like mice. They don't get into everything. I don't find no droppings or anything.
If you want to, do you see it occasionally?
Yeah, every now and then, a lot of it'll run through. It's pretty quiet normally, but out of the corner of my eye, yeah.
Have you tried to squeak it up so you can actually see it?
Yeah, I do a little. And then disappear and look out somewhere else. You know, it's a neat little guy. You know?
Suck on the back of your hand and make that squeaking sound, and they'll come out and take a look around. Well, great. Yep. Good luck.
All right. So there you go. Get your nerve and you're all right.
There you go. Well, tell you what, whether it's ermine or it's field mice or it's, we haven't talked about eagles yet, but I'm sure we'll get to eagles at some point in the conversation here. There's always lots to talk about when Scott comes by, and we're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back to take your questions. You stay with us. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for listening in. If you have a question, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Gloria in Waukesha has been waiting a bit, so let's go to her. Gloria, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hello. I love your show.
Thank you.
I love it. Anyways, I have a question about birds in my chimney. Last August, September, something in there, we have a masonry chimney. I hear all this tweeting in there, and I thought it was bats, which I don't want in my chimney. And so after a while, it dawned on me and research, those were probably not bats, but were chimney swifts, maybe, and I could see them if I went outside. I could see them going in and out. All right, so they were gone in September, I guess, and I don't mind that, and I'm thinking that's okay, but I really don't want bats in my chimney. And is there a way to keep bats out without keeping those other birds out?
Probably not.
I don't think so.
So tell me, Gloria, you, when the birds were occupying the chimney, you'd go out in the evening just before dark and you'd see the birds coming and going.
Right.
How many birds? Two or three or 20 or 30?
Well, oh, no. I didn't see 20 or 30. A couple. If I pounded on the fireplace door, oh, my God, lots of
activity.
Chirping.
Yeah. Mm. You should probably put a cap on that.
Your chimney, the only way you can be sure that nothing is in your chimney, which is probably the preferred alternative, is to put an animal-proof chimney cap on, which is basically like a hardware cloth cap. There are many commercial ones. A chimney sweep or an animal control person or somebody who doesn't, in the family, who doesn't mind climbing around up there could put one up easily and inexpensively, and the problem is completely solved, period. End of story. You, of course, with any animal proofing issue, you want to make darn sure there's nothing in there before you slap the cap on because you don't want to trap them in there.
Right.
But that's ultimately the easy solution. I don't believe there's anything you could do that would leave the chimney accessible to birds, but not bats.
Oh.
So you're going to have to make a decision one way or the other. But I would have somebody, if they return this summer, I'd have somebody who knows their birds come over and check them out. Chimney swifts are easy to identify. They're described in the bird books as flying cigars. They're kind of cigar-shaped, and they have backwards sweeping wings, like narrow wings like a jet fighter. They're very good flyers. They've become rather unusual because a lot of the big industrial chimneys they used to occupy by the thousands are no longer available. So if you have chimney swifts, that's a pretty cool thing. And there are probably folks who would be, you know, who would try and help you. There are ways to make artificial homes for them. And there might be something you'd want to get involved with if they're swifts. If, on the other hand, it's a family of starlings, then you want to get rid of them anyway. So I think the first step in your process is to get somebody over there when the birds are available to make a positive identification on what you have. And if there are probably anything other than chimney swifts, then the next step is to rather quickly employ that cap, and that's the end. That's the end of the story. If they are swifts, then you should get some help from the DNR's Bureau of Endangered Resources or the Natural Heritage Group or a local Audubon Society or whatever. And I think they might be very interested in helping you both take care of and potentially expand that colony.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Appreciate it. Good luck. Hope that's the case. Jane in Eau Claire, your turn now. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
I have a question about flying squirrels. Last fall and early winter, we enjoyed watching flying squirrels coming to our squirrel feeder every night, and then they disappeared. And I haven't seen them for maybe a couple of months. And I'm wondering, do they hibernate, or did something just happen to them? We're hoping to get them back.
And you probably will. The fact that they've been lying low for a couple of months, quite a few, there were a couple of things that happened this winter. Number one, at least in some parts of the state, it was a fairly open winter with below normal snowfall. And that, coupled with a huge acorn crop last fall, meant that there was food everywhere and it was accessible. So we usually have five or six squirrels at our feeders constantly throughout the winter. I've yet to see a squirrel on the feeder since last November. These are gray squirrels, though.
Squirrels.
Yeah, I understand
these
that, but it doesn't make any difference. Most of those small animals will either find natural food if they can, or when it's really cold, as it has been for that stretch from Christmas into January and recently, they'll just hole up and den up for the duration of that bad weather. So it's quite possible nothing bad has happened. It's also quite possible that, hey, their nest tree was knocked over in one of the windstorms we had in the fall, and they relocated further away from your house and aren't visiting anymore. But you'll just have to wait and see how that plays out.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Chris emailed to comment about the white deer west of Wisconsin River. She understands a Stratford, Wisconsin family was breeding white deer. The father passed away and the family let the deer go. She doesn't know if that's...
Geez.
But that's the rumor. She's been told she's seen quite a few white deer as well in Wisconsin Rapids, I think, area, probably.
Oh, well, that's disappointing to hear, simply because that's why Florida's overrun with everything from boa constrictors to assorted other things, and why we have exotic animals all over the place. But if that's what happened, it's over and done with. But again, we talked about that earlier, and I think the course of action, if people are uptight about it, is to start with the DNR and see what happens there.
Rick emailed, and we can't show this, unfortunately, but he did wonder about an animal that was killed between Monroe and New Glarus, wondering what it was. Looks like a mink, doesn't it, Scott?
It is a mink. It's a dead mink upside down in the grass, and that white or cream-colored throat patch is very distinctive on wild mink.
A big giveaway. And on to our next caller, Chris in Oshkosh next. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
So I grew up in Oshkosh, and I've only seen here like gray squirrels and brown squirrels. And then like 2 years ago, all of a sudden there were black squirrels, and I was like, whoa, that's crazy. And I was wondering, is there a reason that like you find like black squirrels in some areas and not in others, and mm-hmm. why they kind of like move like that throughout a region?
Well, they don't actually move around the countryside, but they it happens in place. It's a genetic issue, a color phase. So a black squirrel is a perfectly normal gray squirrel, except it's black. So black squirrel is not a species. Gray squirrel is the species, and gray squirrels can be gray. They usually are. That's the primary color phase. They can also be golden yellow or essentially light brown color. It's usually referred to as a Lady Isabella squirrel. But they can also come with light with a dark tail, dark with a light tail, and just about any combination in between. And once some of those color, and a white, of course, as well. So once one of those color phases pops up in the population, especially if it's in a city park or urban area where squirrels are not subjected to some of the mortality factors or predation that they might out in the countryside, then those odd colorations tend to become more common. And for whatever reason, the black color phase is far more common in the northern part of the state than it is in the southern. So it's quite, I mean, it's unusual for me to either visit our place in Price County for a week or spend any time at the University Field Station around Woodruff and not see one or more black squirrels on every visit, whereas it's really an extraordinarily unusual circumstance down here.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Chris. Nick in Cottage Grove, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one of those. I have that Illustrated Wisconsin Bird book. I can't remember the author, but it's a real famous book. And I also just got a new bird feeder at Wild Birds Unlimited. And it took me a while to get birds, but about a week and a half into it, I've started getting just one species of these, kind of a dusty yellow bird. And they're not like a golden finch, and they almost look like a sparrow. I don't know if they're a type of warbler. I was just curious if you knew of any of a type of birds that migrated up like by the Green Bay area.
And when did these birds show up?
I would say about a month, less than a month ago.
Okay, and they're dusty yellow or kind of a dirty olive green, and their wings are dark.
Yep.
They're goldfinches.
They are goldfinches.
They are goldfinches, and if you watch them here as spring progresses, the males will turn brilliant yellow once they molt for the breeding season.
Oh, see, I've only seen them when they're like the brilliant colors, so I thought they were something else.
I think I counted more than 50 of them on our feeders yesterday, and they all look about the same right now. But it won't take them long. Won't take them long to turn into the wild canaries you're more familiar with.
Yeah, I was hoping they were like a warbler or something, but that's cool.
Well, yeah, that's cool, too.
The reason they're not is that most of our warblers are insect eaters, and that's probably not what you're putting in your bird feeder.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks, Nick. Appreciate the call. And Cheryl in Bessemer, Michigan, we'll go to you next. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love that subject of the ermines because I had one last winter. I've had them off and on all my life. I'm 63. I mean, I ran into them when I was kids, out snowshoeing, whatever. But last winter, I had one come in my house. And I have a big old mean cat, and they kind of had a truce. And it'd come in for some kibbles, you know, some kitty kibbles. And every now and then, and when I'd be making fish, I'd put a little dish out and put some walleye cheeks, you know. But anyways, it was really fun to watch, and it was really fun to watch when they're on the hunt because they let out a death call. And their fur sticks out, and they just go tearing through the house. But they're so much fun. I called the DNR guy, and he says, oh, you're the ermine whisperer, aren't you? I says, maybe.
Good story, Cheryl. Well, there's another person that's had an ermine in the house and enjoyed it.
They're all over the place, Larry. They're all over the place. Actually, they're not that. They're a relatively common animal, but they're just not commonly seen.
Yeah.
But them entering a home and becoming semi-pet-like, and that's pretty unusual.
Very unusual. Good. Thanks for that story, Cheryl. Appreciate it. And you know what? Bob emailed to say that there are so many turkeys on the west side of Madison that they're taking over food sources in open areas. And is there anything that can be done with this proliferation of wild turkeys on Madison's west side?
Probably not, except that here in late winter, the birds are still flocked up in huge flocks. There could be hundreds of them in a flock. And once the breeding activity commences here and hunting pressure, I think the season opens April 18th, those flocks will disperse, the hens will disappear to nest, the gobblers will be off doing their thing, and I think the problem will take care of itself before too long, at least for the summer.
Let's go to Patty in Menominee Falls then. Patty, hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a couple of questions about this cougar that's roaming in my neighborhood. We've got several people who have seen him in their yards or caught them on the trail cams. And I'm curious about their just general habits and whether or not or how fearful I should be when I'm outside or my kids are outside or my dog is outside.
Yeah.
And what do you think's going to happen with this cougar? You know, why is he still here? There's obviously not a mate for him.
Well, many of those are questions for which there's no definite answer. All we can say is that, you know, cougars... I've been on this show with Larry for a long, long time, and cougars were the bane of our existence for many years because there was never any documentation. And then with the onset of everybody having a trail camera, all of a sudden, wow, they're all over the place. And everybody, I think, has seen the video of this particular cougar walking up to someone's living room window and
looking in,
going up with its paws. Hey, what's going on in there? So that makes people a little fidgety, but history would suggest that this cougar, like all that have gone before it, when some blood sample or whatever was collected so they could figure out something about its origin, most are traced back to the Dakotas, to wild populations. They're virtually all young males that are dispersing, and they're just passing through Wisconsin. And I think we've found them now all the way. One that had a track record, I think, made it all the way to New England.
Yeah.
Before it was killed by a car, which is the fate of a lot of them eventually. So this one's been around for a little while now. It, you know, may have found a good spot to take down a deer or whatever, and that's kept it around for a few days. But history would suggest that it's going to be gone soon, if it isn't gone already. And should you be concerned? Well, there's no track record that suggests that it's much of a threat. We haven't had any, you know, dangerous interactions with people, and the animals are usually on the move. So I guess my answer may seem a little strange, but it's going to be that given the day-to-day issues or threats we all face in crossing the street or, you know, all the things we do on a daily basis that we don't give a second thought to, I wouldn't give a second thought to the fact that a cougar has been seen in your area either.
If you have, you know, your dog, you mentioned you have a dog. If the dog's just out and running around all the time, that, you know, it's possible.
Keep that dog inside for a while.
Yeah, that's what I would suggest, too. Ed in Woodruff, your turn. Hi, Ed.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to get Scott's perspective on a new wetland bill, what kind of impact it might have on wildlife across the state. And I read an article, you know, I think I believe in a Journal of Wildlife Management, about muskrat populations declining across in North America, if this might have a potential impact on them too. And another question, when will you do another fireside chat at camp?
Well, if you'd like another fireside chat at Kemp, call the folks at Kemp and say, hey, why don't you get Craven up here for a fireside chat? And one thing will lead to another, and I'll be there. So I may push that idea forward, but seriously, if you'd like to see one, just call Carla or Scott at Kemp and say, hey, why not have them up for another chat, and I'll be there. So anyway, on the wetland situation, I'm going to be pretty general and say that overall, and there have been some really good reviews on this in the papers. There was a really good review in the most recent issue of Outdoor News. I think most people, especially in the conservation community, would say that Wisconsin had a good series of wetland protection laws that did not need to be messed with. And if there was some issue with perhaps uneven application or uneven treatment of permit applications when wetlands were involved in development or whatever, that kind of thing was a procedural issue that could have been and should have been resolved. But weakening at this point, they're not making wetlands anymore, and anything that reduces or eliminates wetland habitat in the country, for my part, I'd say that's a bad thing. And surely there may be a, you know, an isolated low spot in a development that, hey, you take a critical look at that, and you know, maybe there's an opportunity to move forward with some other plan. But in general, these isolated wetlands, the types they're talking about that don't have federal protection, are very beneficial as wildlife habitat and for water retention and water filtration and all the benefits that wetlands provide. And they should not lose the protection they have, in my opinion.
Yeah,
so,
there we go. All right, thank you very much. And they would have could have an impact on something like the muskrat population.
Sure, or anything else that lives in that wetland environment.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you very much for calling, Ed. Appreciate your call. Don wondered about coyote pups. How many are normal and, you know, in a group? And also the males, are they sterile at certain times of the year? They're not.
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's typically, as there is with most species, a primary breeding season, and coyotes are a social animal that travel in family units or extended family units. Excuse me.
How many pups would be born?
Normal litter size, I think it'd be, you know, 3 or 4 to 6 or 7, or maybe a larger litter occasionally. Probably not all of them surviving, but they're doing just fine.
Yeah. Nice, interesting piece in the Wisconsin State Journal this past Sunday with talking about coyote and fox and their relationship. It seemed to be figuring out how to work together.
Yes, right here.
Or
in
live together.
I think then the key thing there is that's right here in the greater Madison environment where there are animals on the UW campus and in people's backyards and whatnot, and they're thriving in that environment and seem to be getting along okay.
Yep. And Todd and Delavan emailed to say in the past couple of weeks he's seen and heard sandhill cranes and wonders if it's unusually early. I don't think so, is it?
No, the cranes are usually back pretty early, and I was reading one of the comments, says, what the heck do they eat this time of year, because the wetlands are still frozen, and most of them I'm seeing are out in windswept cornfields looking for waste corn, just like the geese are.
Yeah, we've been seeing a lot of them out there. Well, Scott, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us. You're back on May 2nd.
I can hardly wait.
I can hardly wait either.
I can hardly wait because 4 days later will be the opening of the fishing season.
You're exactly right. Scott right. Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. And as I said, he will be back on May 2nd. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about home improvement with home improvement specialist Chad Spade. Talk about smart design and sometimes with aging in mind and placed as a priority on your home improvement. Thank you so much for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.